Hi everyone. Buenas tardes. I'm so excited that you're all here for this colloquium on translation with our readers of last evening, Lila Semborain and Rosa Alcala. And I know I saw a lot of you guys at the reading, so I know you know just how wonderful it was. And I, for one, am really interested in hearing more about the dual poem that you read. I was talking with someone after the reading, Julian Etienne, who's in the Mexican consulate, and he said that he could hear and understand both sides of the poem simultaneously. I thought that was so cool. I know that you guys probably have questions as well, and we're just going to turn the mic over to Lila and Rosa, and thank you both for being here.
So thank you so much for having us again, talking about our work.
Yes. So I guess the idea for the colloquium was we were going to have a dialogue, and the reason we thought of having a dialogue and asking each other questions is because our process of translation has been in the form of a dialogue. We collaborate when I translate, but because Lila is living, and like, you know, when you translate dead people, and you can talk to dead people, right? But it's a little harder to get a response. So with Lila, we've had this ongoing conversation about her work, and that helps me to translate her. And I imagine that it also helps you to think about your own work when those questions are asked. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start off with a question for Lila, and then we're going to go back and forth and hope that something emerges that could be useful in sort of opening up a discussion about translation. So when I started translating Lila's work, this was, I was, I was probably in my 20s. Yeah, I was in my 20s, and I really hadn't translated that much. So I really credit Lila for teaching me how to translate, because she gave me, she put her trust in me, and she allowed me to sort of work through some of the questions of translation and sort of start to create my own approach to translation, right? I had read some translation theory. I knew what I liked and didn't like in poetry. I mean, you know, I didn't have zero tools with me, but she allowed me to sort of hone my skills as a translator. And in the process of translating her work, I've asked her so many questions. And I think that it's very difficult as a poet, because I'm also a poet, to answer questions about your own work, right? So, you know, someone will ask you, like, well, why you have that image there? And you're like, I don't know. I mean, you're really the least articulate person usually about your own work. And so I wanted to ask Lila, I mean, is it difficult? And I say was, because hopefully we'll continue collaborating. I know that lately I haven't had as much time as I'd like to. But I wanted to ask you that, how has it felt to have to respond to all of these questions, to have to come up, you know, when I say to you, well, why is this here? What does this mean? Why are you putting this here? I have to understand the context of it. Is it difficult to enter your work in that way? And do you actually learn something about it? I know that sometimes you sort of have left it vague and given me the opportunity to interpret it myself, which I think is extremely generous and allows for maybe even a more complex translation. But that's, I mean, what is it? How does it feel to be put on the spot on your own work in order for it to be translated?
Well, first of all, I don't think you were inexperienced at all when you started, because she had already translated the work of Cecilia Vicuña, which is very complex, and because the mix of languages and the structure of Quechua in Cecilia's work is very complex. So already when we began working together, I completely trusted you. So I didn't have any, like, mixed feelings. Oh, you're a beginner. I didn't even think about that. So I think the process of the dialogue that we had is always very good for me, in the sense that These are so precise questions that she generally does, that you have to explain what does it mean, certain part of the work, that it makes you think a lot of what you are doing. And especially, and the other part that I was thinking about is that in my writing, I think, and in every writing, there is always a secret. There is something that is hidden, and that something that we are not saying through those words. And this is my case. One of my books is called Guardians of the Secret. Maybe poetry is, for me, a secret very well guarded. So in the process of translation, that secret has to be revealed. So the translator can understand what is going on in the work. So I always thought as a translation, I thought it about half an hour ago when I was trying to think about the questions, always at the last minute. And I think about translation now as a kind of a detective work, because you're trying to see all these kind of clues and to understand so deeply what is going on in a text that I see your work as a kind of a detective work. And so my question to you was, do you have the sensation of a detective when you translate, trying to unfold these kind of secrets that the work is trying not to reveal?
That's a good question. Do I feel like a detective? I don't know if I thought of it in terms of detective work. I mean, I think that there's a way when I'm reading it. I mean, my process normally when I'm translating is that sometimes it almost feels like sort of automatic writing, that I'm reading the work and also trying to find the English equivalent with the other hand. And that's a very, very sort of rough early draft of it. But something for me, because I am bilingual, is that a kind of the rhythm of Spanish, and particularly Lila's, I mean, if you've read Mauve Sea Orchids, it's this thing where it's this wave, you know, these long lines. The syntax is incredibly important to the work. And so when you're reading it, you feel like there's this unfolding in it, and you have to give yourself to that unfolding. I mean, that's part of the secret, too, because it's not the meaning of the words. It's this kind of undertow, right? Mm. It's this thing that's kind of pushing through the work that your body has to give into, just like the body of the speaker gives into, you know, the movement in the water, mm-hmm. or the love glands, or this way where, you know, we don't have control, right? There's this kind of chemical processes going on that keep us from having logical or sort of rational control over our bodies, thank God, right? But I think poetry does that too. It kind of sort of has this driving force underneath that pulls you in, that's about the sound, that it's about the tone, that's about the music, that's about a suggested meaning. And I think that's the first part that I try to give myself to before doing the detective work. Because if you do the detective work immediately, you're trying to find the clue, and sometimes the clue is there in something that is not a clue. Like you're looking for, well, where's the secret key under here? But the thing is that everything else might be just as important, and it's just this kind of sensation that you're trying to gather. And I've often pointed to the syntax as the first thing to getting to the meaning of the work. Mm-hmm. When you're translating, as you might imagine, is the syntax might change because you're trying to make sense in another language, so you might have to rearrange word order, right? So it sounds natural in the English. I sometimes try to create lines that don't sound natural in the English in order to retain that syntax, because, first of all, her poetry doesn't always sound natural in Spanish either. I mean, do you know what I mean? It's not necessarily just a conversational Spanish, or it's poetry, right? I mean, she manipulates the language in a certain way, and she causes a certain cadence and a certain movement in that Spanish, so that I try to replicate that in the English. I mean, without it turning it to senseless, you know, order, but trying to create that so that one thing leads to another. And if you, in the last part that I translated, the body that is moving through water, as it's moving its head from one side to another, is seeing different things, right? So it's seeing rocks, it's seeing the ocean, it's seeing the ocean, then it's seeing the sky, it's seeing the sun. That word order is specific because we're following the movement of the body. If you don't have the word order, you don't see the things specifically in that order, and that's what I was trying to retain. I know that doesn't answer your question because I don't think I thought of myself as a detective, but immersing yourself in that, I guess, is kind of like being a detective.
Yeah, no, well, I was thinking in, maybe I was not thinking in that particular poem when mm-hmm. I was asking the question, mm-hmm. and because it's true that what I find very difficult about translating is that when I write, it's like entering into a state of a certain rhythm. In the moment that I enter in a rhythm is the moment that I feel that I'm really writing. So for me, it is very amazing also that you could capture. That's the thing that most attract me about your work, that you could capture the rhythm of my writing. I don't know how to explain it, because it's as she explained also, it's such a bodily thing. It's almost like when I'm writing, I'm almost moving. I don't write in the computer. I write in notebooks. So it's when I feel this rhythm is the moment of the writing. But the other amazing thing also with Rosa's work is that she translated first Guardians of the Secret. No, we mm-hmm. had that experience first. Well, first you translated something else, but in Guardians of the Secret, the poems are very short, some of them. Mm-hmm. And many times I read, I did bilingual readings, and I didn't, always there is a problem about yourself reading in English and in Spanish. It seems like you're reading in Spanish and then in English, and then you have to do the same thing, you know, the same emotion in the other language. It's very weird to do it oneself. So with Guardians of the Secret, I decided to read one poem in Spanish and another one in English and another one in Spanish, or maybe a longer one in English and a shorter one in Spanish, and make a mix of both languages. Not as yesterday, no, I was doing it myself, and there was, in Rosa's translation, there is not, for me, a sensation that I'm changing the language, which mm-hmm. this is very amazing. You know, like when I read in both languages, especially short poems, I don't feel like there is a change of the rhythm. That's why I can continue. And of the syntax, as you mentioned. So it's all like a flow, no? And so I think that is fantastic about her work. I don't have a question about that. I'm just expanding about what you just said.
Well, I have a question for you, because you were talking about translating and the kind of things the way a translator might interpret or inhabit your work or see your work. So Madvas was, Mopsy Orchids was translated by two people, by myself yeah. and Monica de la Torre. I think the reason for that was I had translated a section and then I was writing my dissertation or moving yeah. to El Paso or something, some major, you know, upheaval. And I said, I really can't work on this now. And that you found Monica, who's an amazing translator. I don't know
if
she was here.
But I was desperate in that moment.
You were desperate.
Because you tell me, I cannot do it.
I know.
You get
attached. It was like a breakup. No, it wasn't. It was tough, but we worked it out. No, it was really difficult. I mean, I think that's, you know, I mean, just as an aside, I form relationships with people. I mean, you don't translate someone's work the way that you like cash someone's check at the bank, you know. I mean, it's not just this kind of exchange that ends once. At least for me, I've formed like real personal relationships with people. So, you know, I consider Lila one of my dearest friends, and so there's this kind of, and you know, it's interesting because after a while, it helps to know that person. And I find it a real privilege to be sort of completely part of their creative process. And so at that moment that I couldn't do it, it was difficult to say no. It's always difficult to say no to Lila, because she makes it really easy to work with her, to tell you the truth. So she found Mónica de la Torre. So the question is, Mónica de la Torre has translated amazing people, and is a very good translator, a very good poet. She was here. I don't know if any of you have seen her. She was here, and she translated the first part. So it's curious to me how you found the process differ from translator. Do you think that you learned different things about your own work from what she saw, from what I saw? Did you have certain expectations of what a translator does, and then you had another translator? I'm just curious.
Yes. With Mónica was interesting because... also because of Moves the Orchids, it's a book that for me has different tones in each part. So the first part of the book has that pedantic tone that was mentioned yesterday, which is true. It has, but it's a more like intellectual, mocking intellectual tone that I was using in that moment to... create like a theory of perception, completely invented, and I don't know, having fun with it, but using the tone of an academic paper, which didn't turn out completely like that, no. But all the nexos, ¿cómo se dice? The word that you, los nexos que se usan.
Oh, the
connecting words. All the connecting words are like however, and this, you know. De esta manera.
I'm trying to remember what it is. I am the translator. I'm like, I don't know how it's said in English. I have no idea. I can't remember.
I was teaching composition, so to people writing in Spanish, so I had to teach them all these kind of words, so I was tired of those. But I use all those words, and Mónica is a very bright and intellectual person who really connected with this kind of... It's not a joke because it's not funny the way that I wrote it, but she connected very well with this kind of pseudo-intellectual thing that I was doing, mixed with, at the same time, with something very intuitive, no? I think that was great that she was doing the translation for this part. And the second part, it's like a more prophetic, let's say, kind of prophetic writing in Malvas. And I was afraid that it was going to look very New Agey. So for that... Mónica was very good in that sense, because always when you are in the process of translation, which is also for me a process of writing, because sometimes when I'm writing, they are doing the translations at the same time because I have a reading or something, and I need to translate this work, yes. And so then desperately
I was like,
calling.
I need this by Monday.
Yes,
I'm like, it's Sunday, Lila.
So then it gives you the opportunity to completely rethink of what you are doing, or maybe this is awful. What did I do? When you see the translation, you say, what did I do here? So then you have to go over it and correct it. And it was a very good experience. Also, Mónica mentioned me also that for her it was really hard to get into the rhythm of my Spanish from Argentina, which is completely different from the rhythm of the Spanish in Mexico. So for her it was like a challenge to get into the rhythm, because she puts certain accents in different places of the sentence. And so when I went over the translation, I was reading it in English with her, and I said, and it didn't go in the moment, you know, like I got a little bit lost sometimes in the middle of a sentence because it didn't went with the rhythm that my Spanish has. And she did an amazing job with that, because it got completely like smooth and she could do it. That is what I think about translators, that it was in another place, this question, I don't know where it is. I think that translation is such an act of generosity, because it's like getting completely into the writing or into the experience of writing of another person. And I think Monica and you and other translators as well that I have been working, they have the capacity to get into the minds, because it's getting into the mind of another person to in order to put it in the other language. Do you feel that, like,
this do is I like feel that? Generous?
No, generous. Well, generous, no. But how can you remove yourself from also from your own writing, or how is the relationship between this letting you go in the writing of the other person, and at the same time, it's like three parts, the question, no? How do you let yourself go into the writing of the other person? Then how you recover yourself in the process of reviewing, because that is the process that comes afterwards. Mm-hmm. And the last part I forgot. I have something else, but...
Well, I wanted to touch upon, and I'm going to answer those questions. I think it leads into it. I wanted to touch upon this thing that you said about that, and that's important to remember, I think, is that there's not one Spanish or one English. There are Englishes, right? There are Spanishes. Mm. There are variants of a national language. Mm. And I think that I had never thought of that before, but I guess in my case, I mean... you know, Monica La Torre grew up in Mexico, but she grew up bilingual because her mother speaks English, her mother's American, her father's Mexican. My parents are Spanish, but I grew up here, and I don't think that I have this kind of hardened Spanish of a particular way, because I grew up in New Jersey with so many different kinds of Spanish speakers. So I feel very much a chameleon. I mean, I do have a certain Spanish accent, but I go to Spain, it doesn't sound Spanish enough, apparently, right? I'm immediately like, where are you from, the Canary Islands? Which maybe you won't understand as a joke, but it's like the island off of Spain.
Yeah.
Where are you from exactly? And I think that maybe I can inhabit the Spanish, because I've been used to doing that my entire life, which is to inhabit whichever Spanish is present, and maybe very in different variants of Spanish, and I've sort of cobbled together this kind of weird, you know, Spanish of different places. And in El Paso, it's changing a lot with the Mexican influence, and I have students from all over Latin America. So, I mean, how do I remove myself from it? Well, you know, I don't really feel the necessity. I never end up writing like the people I translate, believe it or not. It just doesn't happen. I've never written like Cecilia Vicuña. I've never written like Lila. It doesn't enter my work. Why, I'm not sure. But like I said to Gail at lunch today, is that I very much feel that I write best not when I open a notebook to write, but when I enter another work. Because I feel like I'm gathering, I'm sort of, you know, cultivating something out of that work. And it's not so much that you're imitating or you're stealing or you're trying to take something. It's feeding you, because it's making you think. It's kind of giving you this kind of energy or food for your own work, right? And it's encouraging you. I mean, you see, wow, this is this amazing work, and you want to go write. So I feel like when I translate, I also write. I mean, it's a productive time, right? And I think about, you know, the revision process is one that takes longer than the first drafts, because you, and this is probably true of my own writing, is you really want to get it to a certain place. No, I think actually the revision process takes longer with translation than with my own work. And I've had the situation where either Lila or Cecilia Vicuña or Lourdes Vázquez, who's another person who I translate, or who I have translated, say, Rosa, it's perfect, let's just send it off. And I say, it's not. I mean, we have to revise it again. And I insist on it. And it's not always something I want to do. I have other stuff to do. I teach classes, you know, have a partner who wants to see me every once in a while. You know, it's not always something, I mean, it's not, I don't sort of relish having to do it all the time, but for me, it's a responsibility. And it's a responsibility to Leela. I've committed to her, so that's it. You know, it's not like I'm only halfway committed to her. And also, it's my work in the world. I mean, it's a reflection of what I do. So I try to go over it as many times as possible. And sometimes to the point where it's just like, I'm nitpicking, and I know it. I know that I'm just like, what do you think we should do with this word, Leela? What do you think we should do? And you're just like, enough already. I can tell you're just sort of like, okay, let's just move on. But, you know, I the revision process, I just think is something that maybe is part of that generosity, but I don't see it as a generosity. I see it as just part of a commitment, you know?
No, but it's a, I think it's the best part, no? Because this is the moment that you are seeing your work in another light completely. You are seeing your work in another language. And here comes Rosa, the translator, with these weird questions about what is going on here. What are you trying to say here? That is a question. Like, what are you asking me, please? And we spend maybe hours in the phone, mm-hmm. talking about specific details, and I think it's a lot of fun. Also,
yeah.
I don't know for you, but for me, I enjoy it a lot.
It is. You also have to do research. I mean, for myself, I had to do some research outside of it. I mean, there are ekphrastic poems in Guardians of the Seeker and another series called Carnivorous Flowers. And so for me, I've had to find copies or, you know, images.
Reproductions,
that's what I'm looking for. Hmm. Reproductions of the paintings.
Now I'm the translator.
Now you're the translator. reproductions of the work, either of sculpture or painting. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily help, believe it or not, because you're reproducing a poem, not a painting, right? So you're trying to see what she sees. But having to do that research is also, I think, really productive for me, just to go outside of my own interests. I may not necessarily look up... Well, I love Jackson Pollock, so that's not true. Mm-hmm. But I may not look up some other painter that she's interested in, or I may not... I was introduced to the work of Alejandro Twombly,
yeah.
Right Side Twombly's son, and that was really exciting. I didn't even know that he had a son.
Yeah.
You know, so that to me, and also finding out about the anatomy of the eye, which
oh, yes.
you talk a lot about in Guardians of the Seeker, in order to figure out what the heck you were saying with all this fluid. There was fluid everywhere, and it was connected to amniotic fluid, and I don't know what this woman's talking about. And, you know, once you learn about the eye, you realize that she really is just drawing from this information that's there. It's scientific information, right? She's making poetic. But I have a question for you, Leela.
Okay.
Because we're talking about the paintings.
Yeah.
And I know that you've been very influenced by art, by visual art. And you've written a lot of ekphrastic poems. They've been published in art catalogs rather than, you know, in poetry collections, necessarily anthologies. And that painters have asked you to write poems for their paintings, which I think
yeah.
is incredibly sexy and exciting to be asked to, for a painter to be like, can you write some poems for my paintings? That's really so flattering, right? And so I wanted to, do you see it as a kind of translation yourself, this relationship with art that then is turned into
a poem?
A poem.
I don't see it as a translation because when I'm looking at a work of art, it's more like I feel like a connection. Sometimes, not all the times, no, but I feel a connection with a work of art. That work of art is telling me something that I feel I should write. And it's more like a way of understanding something about, always about myself, I think, because in the end, a work of art is positing some kind of question that it's moving you in a certain way that I want to know what is going on there? What is that movement that is going on in that moment? And so I cannot see it as a translation because I don't see it as that I'm trying to translate what is being shown in an image or in colors, for example. But it in a way, I have to agree with you in the sense that with the Jackson Pollock painting, Guardians of the Secret, there was a big show in MoMA. I'm very fortunate that I live in New York, that I could develop this work, because you have amazing shows there all the time, and there was this retrospective of Jackson Pollock in the 90s, I think, and I saw this work by Jackson Pollock that in the moment I saw it, it was like an image of a dream that I had when I was 20 years old or something. There was a time that I wrote all my dreams and I was reading Jung when I was in my 20s, so I was writing all my dreams every day. And when I saw the Jackson Pollock, like 20 years later, the painting, I say, oh my God, this is my dream. This is my dream, exactly the dream. And this is what I wrote in the book, in the poem. So that was like the opposite. Like the painting was a translation of my dream. Of course, this was not true at all, because then I went back to the dreams and I say, I have to look at that dream. And there were two dreams in that painting. But in my memory, it was only one. So it was very interesting for me how memory works in relation to dreams, because you mix everything in a way. I was telling Rosa that now that she's breastfeeding, this has nothing to do with translation, but...
Sure it does.
when I had my son I was breastfeeding him, it was like they pushed the bottom like this and I was remembering all my dreams. Many dreams came like this. This is also something that I wrote in Guardians of the Secret, no? Because it's a book about vision and about inner visions and ways to see, different ways of seeing, with glasses, without glasses, partially blinded, and many different perspectives of the sense of seeing, more than the abstract seeing or the visionary thing, which it's also in there. But I mean, going back to your question, when I see a work of art, I cannot. You cannot translate images into words. I think it's a different process. Mm-hmm. And but you can translate words into words.
Words into words.
It's what you're translating is words into words, I think,
right.
Not images into words. So it goes through another space,
right.
Or space or area. But yeah. In relation to the works of art, it really helps you to look at the paintings or the images when you're translating the work, or you don't feel like any connection whatsoever, or you say, oh, how that is horrible, what is it writing about? Or
yeah, I mean, I think that's what I said is I don't know if it helps me necessarily to see those paintings. I don't know if it's the key to translating the because really I have to translate what you're seeing, which
yes.
isn't going to be the same thing that I'm seeing. But I find it a responsibility to say that if I'm translating a poem that's called Guardians of the Secret by Jackson Pollock, and I don't try to find the painting to look at it. I mean, it's a responsibility to sort of. I mean, if you're writing about, if poems set in a certain country and you can't place it on the map. I mean, I don't know if you need to go to that country necessarily to translate them. Even though I've spoken to translators who, for example, have gone to a place where a poet lived when they were writing the poems, they can see the balcony they were looking out of when the poems were written. Right. I mean, that perspective can help. But I feel like I need to know what you know to some extent, and at least have that as a reference point, just like looking up a book uh, a a word in a dictionary.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Okay.
But I wanted, because we're talking about the visual, I mean, I don't know how many of you have the Guardians of the Secret, but we're speaking about not being able to translate from images to words and only translating words to words. But there's a section here in which I guess Lila decided that whatever was sort of happening in her head and in her body couldn't be translated to words, and there are images, right? And this is a section of the book. It isn't supplementary, so to say. You know, it's not like illustrations, but it's section 5, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, it's section 5 of the book. So it should be read as part of it, as one section that then follows another. And some of the images, it does reference some of the things that are said in the book, right?
Yes.
I mean, some of the eye, and I think there's the reference to the amniotic fluid.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, here it says líquido amniótico. And I thought a lot about this book while I was pregnant. Not necessarily when I was giving birth, when I was pregnant. I didn't think of your work while I was giving birth, Lila. Well, I was pregnant and also breastfeeding. I thought a lot about this book because you go so deeply into sort of the physical processes of those, you know, of that experience, right? And and I thought, would I have translated it differently if I had had that experience? I don't know. Just like looking up the Pollock painting, or going to Brazil to see that balcony that someone looked out of. I don't know.
So, I don't know, maybe.
Leave question. For,
yes.
Yeah.
Only one thing I want to add to contradict myself, of course.
Oh, sure.
It's like I say that the paintings do not translate into words, but yes, I'm not contradicting. It could translate into shapes, because actually this book, I kind of thought about the shape. That is something that we are we are not talking about. Mm-hmm. I thought about the shape of this book, or the clue of the shape of this book was given to me by a conversation that I had with a Spanish poet, Concha García. We were looking at Mark Rothko paintings in Washington, and so I asked her, how do you write a poem like a Rothko painting? And she told me, those are tones. And so, tones. So then I decided like to mix tones, like to put together different tones in my writing, and also like to shape the book with a justified margin. And I'm looking for a good example with a longer poem, but like, I don't know, like different, you know, like square, like, como se dice, rectangles of text with different tones. And so the shape of a painting can give you, gave me the clue for the shape of the book. Mm-hmm. And this was very good.
Yeah, and Malvas has a shape too that I think, I mean, sometimes I think people just consider it sort of centered on the page, right? But it really isn't, right?
Yeah.
It's not about it being centered on the page, and it's not that it has necessarily particular line breaks, but at least in the section that I translated, the shape of these sections mimics the trace of the body in the water, the wake.
Yeah.
Right? So you see sort of as the body goes through what's left, those traces. So the form relates to the content very closely.
Yeah, that is what I usually do.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
So I guess we wanted to open up the discussion with you.
Oh, we have to turn off.
Oh, okay.
Hours. Okay.
Well, if you guys don't mind, I'd like to start with a question, which is, I really would like to hear a little bit about what it was like for you, Lila, to write in English, and for you, Rosa, to translate into Spanish the poem that you read together last night. I think that's what you said, right? That It was written first in English, then translated into Spanish. Do I have that right?
Yes. Actually, this is the first time I wrote it's not the first time that I write in English, but that I write a poem in English, and I did a translation into Spanish. I did the whole thing, and it was, it was the first time that I did that, and it was a good experience for me because it's completely different from getting the translation from another person, in the sense that you feel that you have more freedom to do whatever you want. You don't have to stick to the text, which I think in the translations and in the process of translation, it's not that I'm not so rigid in terms of the content or of the wording, right. More on the rhythm, right. No? So, but in this case, it was like, okay, well, this is not exactly the same. I don't care. It sounds well in it's. I like how it sounds in English, and I like it to sound in Spanish well, but not if it doesn't mean to do it in the same way. I don't care. It has to have the. It has to have the same sensation that it came from, more than the exact translation. But there are many parts that they are very close also, because there are many words that you say in the same word, like dissolution. Dissolution is exactly the same. So, but what we did for the first time was to read it together, which was quite an experience, no? To read it, to do this kind of superimposition. And I think that when I wrote the poem, the idea of is dissolution? Dissolution. I don't even remember what is the poem about. Dissolution?
Dissonance.
That's why. I knew that I was right. Dissonance. I think that it was the first time that I could get this sense of what the dissonance between... I was not thinking about the dissonance between the languages at all. I was thinking about what is dissonance, what is the meaning of dissonance, because we were supposed to present a collaborative work for an event that Eileen Miles organized in June or in July in New York, which was going to be, everything was going to be in silence. So everybody was going to read poems in a group. We had to present a project, a collaborative project, and all was going to be in silence. So it was a very weird situation. So I was thinking about silence, but the dissonance in silence. The idea of dissonance, and also is like the opposite of Mopsy Orchids. It's more like dissonance, and the sense of not touching. Like, mob is all related to connection, but this poem, Dissonance, is all related to disconnection and lack of the sense of touch, mostly. So it came out that the idea of dissonance was very well expressed by the two languages being together. So now I would like to see how did you feel about reading it together, and about first of all, we did tell about the experience about you reading in Spanish and me reading in English, which it didn't work at the beginning.
Yeah, it really didn't. It happened very quickly. I mean, Lula and I were talking about this before. It's just like I had a crying baby in the hotel. We had to like come up with something quick, and we came to this decision to do it like this because Lila read it first, and she was gonna read the English first and then the Spanish herself. And I just thought, I don't know if I like it way.
Yeah.
Because I saw it when you see it on the page. Can we show it?
I didn't bring
a copy of it. On the page, it's broken up into fragments, and the Spanish and the English go right after each other in these fragments, and they're scattered around the page, sort of like a constellation of words. And when she read it in this linear fashion, I thought that's really not capturing it.
Yeah.
And because Lila is always about sort of connecting the form to the content or having the form say something in addition to the content, I thought it was just sort of, it dissolved that form in the performance.
Yeah.
And so, and then we thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting, since I always read the English, for me to read the Spanish? And it was hard for her to inhabit the English, and it was hard for me to inhabit the Spanish. And we tried it a couple of times, and we kept tripping over it.
It was horrible.
The moment we took on our assigned roles of Spanish, right, the Spanish Argentinian poet and me, the English girl from New Jersey, not English girl from New Jersey, Jersey girl who speaks English, then suddenly it just sort of, you know, we did it once and it really sounded really good, and the second time it sounded amazing. I said, okay, I got to go. And then we did it sort of the third, maybe even the fourth time we read it.
Was
last night. So I wasn't nervous about it though. I mean, because no. I just it came together so beautifully, and it was exactly like you said, the performance reflected the content and the form itself of what you were trying to express, right? And I wonder my question for you, who was here last night? Hmm. Hearing it, I mean, what did you hear and how did you hear it? That's curious for me.
Well, I'll just say I thought it was beautiful, and I do only speak English, and so obviously my attention was going more to the English that I followed throughout, but then there were these moments where the words in Spanish and the words in English are so similar occasionally that there's like this kind of synthesis of sound and meaning. And so there were times when I did feel like I could enter both languages, but most of the time I was with just the English. But it had this kind of haunting echo, musical echo, to have the two languages happening at once.
This was in the text is the English, which was the original language. It's the English is one font. ¿Cómo se dice? Un tamaño más grande. Un tamaño.
Larger size.
It's
font.
A larger size font, and the Spanish is in italics, and one size less. So it's as you said, it's like an echo. What I wanted it to sound is like a little bit removal, so it's not the same margin. The Spanish is a little bit moved to the side. So it's the idea was like to have these two things together, but a little bit removed from each other, como corrido. How do you say that? Mm-hmm. Corrido.
Removed, yeah.
Removed, mm-hmm. Like a little bit removed, no?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what really happened when we were reading it.
Mm. But I was thinking, you know, I mean, maybe in the future we could experiment too with maybe a kind of lack of mastery, which is also dissonance, the discomfort.
Yes.
Of maybe, you know, me reading in Spanish and you reading in English. Or and remember, that was the first time I had ever read it.
Yes.
So I was also kind of tripping over parts because I, you know, had never seen it before. Mm. And I thought that was, you know, interesting. I think we were uncomfortable with it not being, you know, a perfect performance when we did it the first time. But there's something about that discomfort that I think is interesting, because that's what language is, and what trying to understand people across languages is not really always being able to articulate perfectly.
Yeah, that was interesting when we did it, because I wanted to do it in English, because I wrote it originally in English, so I wanted the original language to be my language, but It was like, I don't know, we got completely confused. We couldn't articulate it as we did it in the other way. And also reading it together is confusing, even yeah. though when I was reading in Spanish and she, I said, what, did I say that in Spanish or in, what did I say? You were not this all the time in your head when you were reading it.
I was moving into the English sometimes when I was reading in Spanish and you were moving into the Spanish. We were migrating across.
I don't know if we were changing, but your head was like, where am I? What am I doing? Like that was very interesting.
Right. But the interesting thing too is that dissonancia and dissonance, I mean, you know, are cognates. I mean, they sound and look alike. So when you see it on the page, it's very easy to mix them up.
Yeah.
So I think we were doing that too, where we were sort of like looking for our English word and saying the Spanish word because they look so similar, which I think is a nice, interesting kind of message too. Mm.
Hello? Could you maybe show us a passage where you had to compensate in a way? Like something from your working process?
It says, órgano ocular oculta ocurrencias ordinarias ordenando errores, horrores, humores, ardores. Right? So do you hear that? I mean, even if you don't know Spanish, you can hear that there's the repetition, right, of the O sounds throughout. Errores and ardores are the only ones. So we wanted to find word. Now, luckily, we were able to find mostly words that have that same sound, right, that have the same sound. And so in English, it was ocular organs, obscure, ordinary occurrences, organizing errors, horrors, humans, humors, fervors, right? So there were various words that could be chosen to represent the Spanish properly, but we had to choose words also that reflected that sound in Spanish. And I don't know, I don't think that's exactly the question that you're asking it. I would have to sort of go through this and think about it further. That's a difficult question, by the way. but I think that with something like that, with a line like that, you're never thinking of just what the words are, obviously. You're thinking of that chain of sounds. And you're going to put whatever, and if we had to change the meaning of that completely, we would have.
Yes.
Because the most important thing is to get that ba-ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Mm-hmm. And you've been doing that, Lila. I know that you like this kind of layering of sounds because you do this now.
Oh, yeah.
This kind of sound. And one thing is, you notice she did that last night, and she's done it in other readings.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's like the bum, the one thing after another.
Here is another thing that it's not
oh, yes.
It's corintejado.
This is a good example.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
It's right there. I'd
forgotten about this one.
Yeah, this is... well, why don't you explain it? It's better.
Corintellado is, she's dead
is.
Now. According to my mother, who told me this, I didn't know this the other day, my mother came to visit me and she buys this magazine called Vanidades, which is like, what is Vanidades in the equivalent in
English?
No, not really, because Vanidades, I don't know.
My people.
Yeah, like people. Yeah, it has like all sort of like what's happening in the telenovelas and all this stuff, right? So she buys this, and they have like this these romance novels that are, you know, cut into sections. There's sort of different chapters and eat from month to month, and it's by Corintellado, who is
Corintellado was like very cheap little novels that you read when you were I was 13 years
like
old
romance
about
novels.
Romance and very like written by a Spanish woman that actually I found out that she's the person that more books has sold in the history of Spain after El Quijote. So let me tell you that she was very, very popular all over Latin America. It was amazing. And I every summer I was like reading all the Corintellado books.
Right.
So somehow in this book, this Corintellado appeared because it was like a very, you know, like a scene of seduction, like, you know, the eyes in a moment of seduction. And let's read the poem in both. Mm-hmm. So it's, Él me mira muy de cerca. El verde ocupa casi todo el ojo y el color es tan intenso como hechizante. En los ojos flota una serenidad seductora, un erotismo controlado. Una mirada cautivante, diría Corín Tellado.
So. He looks at me up close. The green takes up most of the eye, and the color is as intense as it is spellbinding. A seductive serenity floats within the eyes. A captivating stare, Danielle Steele might say. So we thought, I mean, if we kept Corín Tellado, it would have meant nothing to the English reader. I mean, there's a good example of Benjamin. The translation does not exist for someone who can read the Spanish. So who would be the equivalent of Corín Tellado, right? And Danielle Steele, immediately, you know what that means. You know the kind of literature that you're going to get when you get, even if you've never read her, right? So Corín Tellado is the same thing. I mean, my mother actually has read her and told me that she's dead. She's been dead forever, but they still publish Corín Tellado, and it's probably someone else writing them. But she's so popular, right? Because people expect certain things of certain kind of writing.
And so. Also because it's obviously that the whole thing is ironic, you know? Like,
exactly.
But at the same time, it's acknowledging that you have that perception also. Even though you are laughing at Corín Tellado, you know Corín Tellado very well and you have read it. Mm-hmm. And a captivating stare.
Which is kind of cheesy, right?
Yeah.
Kind of playing off like what, you know, he looked at me with a captivating stare. We couldn't make... that line wouldn't have been parody if you didn't know who
Corín Tellado
was.
Yeah, exactly.
And is, I guess. But with Danielle Steele, it works. So that's one where we had to... And of course, I knew who Corín Tellado is, but immediately you said when I was translating, so who would be the equivalent of this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that one was right under the other one.
Yes.
That's a good thing that you saw it. Yeah.
Thank you all then for coming, and thank you so much, Rosa and Lila. We really appreciate it. This was wonderful.